You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Landscape architect, journalist, social critic, and public administrator Frederick Law Olmsted designed or co-designed many of our nation's most beloved public parks, including New York Central and Prospect Parks. In his latest documentary, Academy Award-nominated filmmaker Lawrence Hott shows how Olmsted not only largely invented the city park as we know it today, but also changed the country's landscape forever. Frederick Law Olmsted, Designing America, airs tomorrow night at 9 p.m. on Channel 13 here in New York, and I'm pleased that it brings Lawrence Hott back to our show. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm okay. Were public parks and green spaces a priority in America's cities in the 1850s?
Oh, hardly. In fact, it was a very new idea. There were parks, of course. Olmsted did not invent the idea of parks, but most of them were private. Olmsted was brought into the city. It wasn't his idea to put a park in New York, Central Park, the one he's most famous for. But when he got involved with it, he really changed the nature of parks in America.
Did the creation and popularity of Central Park make other cities want to have a park like that?
Well, it was not only the popularity of Central Park, but it was the vision of Olmsted and his partner at the time, Carver Vaux, that made other cities want them. They lined up to hire him. They would say to Olmsted, we want one of those Central Park thingies right here. And Buffalo and Louisville and Rochester and Chicago, they all asked him to come and design their parks. But it wasn't just the cities. It was the campuses and government buildings and eventually even the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago. Olmsted was the most famous landscape architect in the world.
Although he wasn't trained to be a landscape architect, Calvert Vaux was. And he's from London, where there were some pretty great public parks even in the 19th century. Was he bringing the Hyde Park and other parks that he'd grown up with him, or the concept of them, when he worked with Olmsted?
Well, Vaux was an interesting character. He did come from London. He was brought to the United States by Andrew Jackson Downing, who was a famous architect at the time. Downing died in a steamboat accident in the Hudson River, and Vaux needed a partner. So he brought Olmsted in with him for the competition to design Central Park. And so what Vaux contributed to the partnership was his ability to draw. And what Olmsted contributed to the original partnership was his knowledge of the land. Olmsted was really a failure, actually, up until the time he became superintendent of Central Park. This is before he designed it. He had been a land surveyor. He had been a farmer. He had been a writer. He'd been a correspondent. He never made any money at these things, and he couldn't support himself. And when Vaux approached him to help design Central Park, that was his big moment. It wasn't until he was 42 years old, several years later, that he declared himself a landscape architect.
And they went on to create the first landscape architecture firm. Was it a harmonious partnership?
Well, Vaux and Olmsted, they really did their best work in Prospect Park. You know, there's this battle in New York versus Central Park versus Prospect Park. Some people say, well, they practiced on Central Park, but they got it perfect in Prospect Park. And they did very well. They did all kinds of other projects together. But their partnership didn't last very long, only from 1865 or so, when they formed the partnership officially, to 1872. And then they went their separate ways and came back. So the firm that Olmsted founds up in Boston does not include Calvert Vaux at all.
Olmsted had problems with any number of the people he had to work with throughout his career. Was he just stubborn, difficult to work with?
You know, I've been trying to figure out what Olmsted's personality is like. You can see in his letters, particularly to college presidents, where he wrote a letter to the president of Cornell when it was brand new, and he said that your buildings, the way they're set up now, are disgusting and deplorable, and I bet you 200 years from now when we meet on the other side of the River Styx that your buildings will be demolished and mine will still be standing. Well, you can see how far that attitude would get him. He was routinely fired. He was fired from Central Park several times until finally, 20 years after working on the park, he was fired completely. That's what drove him away from New York. He quit the sanitary commission that he headed for 2 years during the Civil War because he couldn't get along with his superiors. So how come he was so successful? It's not only because he was a genius. I think it's because he persevered, because he had a vision. They called him a visionary, a democratic visionary. And because his work spoke for itself. It was so damn beautiful.
He had taken leave from his responsibility overseeing Central Park to be General Secretary of the United States Sanitary Commission, which organized support for the Union Army in the Civil War by furnishing medical care and supplies and supervising volunteer efforts. And then he came back and finished work on Central Park. Now, what were the other designs that were being considered that Olmsted and Vaux's plan beat out?
Well, there were 33 designs altogether. The one people like to talk about is the one by Egbert Vile, which is a great name. The Vile is almost an anagram for evil. I don't think he was evil. He was just untalented, so we say. And he had been the superintendent before Olmsted, and he was a military man. He was very straightforward. So he had a design that was very utilitarian. There were lots of floral designs, and Olmsted deplored regimentation. He didn't like flowers. And to this day, there's always this battle over whether, you know, flower beds should be put into Central Park. And if you take a close look at Central Park, you see there's not a lot of flower beds there. It's really kind of a natural-looking setting. And I use that phrase purposefully because there really is actually nothing natural about Central Park. This is a signature element of Olmsted's design. He was willing to engineer and create the look he wanted, no matter what the land was. He liked to use the natural lay of the land. But Olmsted, but Central Park is one of the most engineered parks in the world.
And he was putting it together with the future in mind. He was interested in what it would look like 40 years from the time he created it. Most people would want to do something that was immediately would have an immediate impact. What was the land that Central Park was put on? What did it look like in 1857?
Well, Olmsted is famous for describing that land as smelly, stink-holed, rendering plants that noxious odors emanated from. It was a very dangerous place. There were these shanty towns there. The rendering plants where they boiled down animals for glue were there. It was 778 acres that at the time the city purchased for $5 million. As we note in the film, it's not hard to pay $5 million for an apartment near Central Park now. And Olmsted spent a year or two clearing the land and getting to know the land when he was tapped by Vaux to help form a design. He had no idea that he was going to become a landscape architect. He was doing that job for one very simple reason. He understood drainage. He had been a farmer. He knew how to get water off the land. The land was wet, and he had to make it habitable in a way, you know, make it appropriate for a park. And that was his job. He didn't know he was going to become a landscape architect.
How did he think New Yorkers would use Central Park?
Well, his idea about parks really grew. He had a philosophy about it. Basically, he was a reformer. He had a background in reform. One of the great things about Olmsted is that he's part of this transcendental movement, and he's also part of the abolitionist movement. He didn't start out that way, but he's the first foreign correspondent for the New York Times, where the foreign country involved was the U.S. South. He goes down there and writes a series, 54 articles on the South, and he becomes radicalized. He even ships howitzers and guerrilla war manuals out to the Free Kansas movement. So when he gets involved with parks, he's thinking, you know, how can parks help people? And he has this idea that there's a salubrious effect of open space, a peace of mind on people, particularly people who don't have the opportunity to get away. So here's something interesting about Central Park. At the time he's building Central Park, he's visited the Adirondacks, and he knows this is where wealthy people have their playgrounds. And he thinks that New Yorkers who are living in tenements should have the right to see the kind of vistas that the wealthy people can see in a wilderness landscape. So if you go up into the upper northeast corner of Central Park, that's where the ravine is, and you see this beautiful landscape of these bubbling brooks and coming over rocks and little waterfalls made to look like part of the Adirondacks. It's completely engineered. But the idea was, let everybody enjoy this.
Although he did want to impose some of his own ideals on visitors to the park.
Well, Olmsted was a pretty strict disciplinarian. There was a long list of rules that Olmsted came up with, and his name is signed at the bottom of these rules. You know, there's no spitting, no ball playing. As Doug Blonsky, the head of the Central Park Conservancy, says in the film, people would dress up to come to the park. At the same time, he believed in people having fun. He just didn't believe in them changing what he had put there. He hated intrusions. He didn't like zoos. He didn't like swimming pools. He didn't like ball fields. He didn't like tennis courts. He really wanted people to just contemplate nature. Of course, that doesn't work out. Times change. And Olmsted said maybe he would have changed with the times, but he often wrote about – he has a famous quote where he talks about if somebody asked him to design an opera house and then they said, let's put a dipping pool in it and let's turn it into a Baptist Tabernacle Choir and a dog pound. And in the film, we animate those things to show just how absurd it is. And he said, but this is driving him to distraction.
I'm talking with Lawrence Hott, H-O-T-T, whose film Frederick Law Olmsted, Designing America, airs tomorrow night at 9 p.m. on Channel 13 here in New York City. You mentioned that Prospect Park was seen as the better park. Why didn't they just, since Central Park was a success, why didn't they just try to duplicate it?
Well, there's a lot of good reasons for that. One is it wasn't as big. Second, it wasn't the same size. And in fact, the reason that some people think it's a better park is because it wasn't this rectangle, a strict rectangle bounded by the rectilinear streets of New York City. As Tupper Thomas, who's the former head of the Prospect Park Alliance, says, it was kind of blob-like. And they were given a lot of freedom in Brooklyn. The park commissioners there were not as strict as they were in New York City. And they also, or by then, could trust Olmsted and Vaux. Remember, when they did the work in Central Park, they were brand new. Nobody knew them. But by the time they were working in Prospect Park, as Vaux says, when he entices Olmsted to come back, but Olmsted's running a mining company out in Mariposa, California, he entices him to come back by saying, we will have all the freedom we want to do what we want. So the designs in Prospect Park, they did not have to deal with a committee. They just were given carte blanche.
In your documentary, the writer Adam Gopnik compares Olmsted to Walt Disney and Central Park to Disneyland. How does he see them as similar?
Yeah, the landscape architect Faye Harwell in the film says people bridle at the idea of comparing Olmsted to Disney. How can you use them in the same sentence? But Olmsted did what Disney did. He created a fairyland. Olmsted liked to work with the lay of the land, but he understood how to get rid of the nasty things, as we say in the film, hide the drainage, hide the sanitation. But he also created a fantasy for people. And it's a stage. It's a stage set where people can perform and live out fantasies. When Central Park, as soon as it opens, I mean, the first year they're building it, they allow the lake to freeze. And people are skating on the lake. And this is the first time that men and women are actually doing some kind of sports activity together. And a curious thing is that it spawns a business, which is tying, lacing up women's skates because the women couldn't bend over in their skirts. So there's a lot of things that come out of Central Park that you wouldn't think would happen.
How did Olmsted's experiences out west influence how he saw America's wide open spaces? Would our national park system be different without Olmsted? In fact, would they exist?
Well, there's kind of a relay race of the people who influenced American thought on wilderness and preservation, and it starts with the George Perkins Marsh and then the Transcendentalists. But Olmsted's part of that crowd. He knows them, and when he's out west,
do you know John Muir?
Well, there's no evidence that he actually spoke with John Muir. He was in Yosemite just a little bit before John Muir was there, although I think they shared some of the same sentiments. And one of the sentiments, interestingly, that they shared was that Yosemite should be opened up for tourism because they both believed that if people saw it, they would want to preserve it. Now, none of them, they couldn't realize this would happen with how many cars would come to Yosemite. But in his first report on Yosemite, Olmsted was tapped to head the commission to decide what to do with Yosemite. He talks about putting in the winding roads and keeping it safe and opening up and getting people in there. And it's his son, Frederick Law Olmsted Jr., who in 1916 is the consultant with the National Park Service, who writes the rationale. But you have to go back to Niagara Falls to understand Olmsted's impact on preservation, not so much Yosemite. Because Olmsted visited Niagara Falls when he was working on the Buffalo Park system. And there he sees how much trouble Niagara Falls is. It's this great wilderness symbol, and you have to pay to see the falls. And there are factories lining the banks, and there's a terrible smell. And Olmsted says, we have to save this. And he fights a 10 to 15 year battle to get Niagara Falls set aside as a reservation. And then he assigns himself to do the design work, and Vaux come back to work with him. In 1885, the New York State Legislature passes legislation to set aside Niagara Falls, and that leads directly to the Forever Wild Clause in the New York Constitution that sets aside parts of the Adirondacks. Well, that Forever Wild Clause is really the basis of our wilderness legislation. And in 1964, you know, all these years later, the Wilderness Act is passed, and you can draw a direct line back through George Marshall and John Muir and Howard Zionizer, all the way back to Frederick Law Olmsted and his son, and say these are the people who were responsible for the preservation laws that we have in the country.
What did they do with all of the factories that were lining the falls? Did they buy them up and take them down?
They did. They did. They bought them up and they tore them down. Now, there's still power plants around the falls, but they didn't buy up all of the land. But they bought up the land that was that they could get, and then they built the Goat Island Niagara Falls Reservation.
Now, you mentioned the roads into Yosemite. Isn't Olmsted also involved with the creation of the concept of the parkway?
Yes, Olmsted, he actually is the first one to use the word parkway. He's also the first one to use the word midway. Can you believe that? The Midway Plaisance at the Chicago World's Fair, the Columbia World's Exposition. He invents the word Fenway. I say inventing it is a little too strong. He carried around a 17th century dictionary of old English words. And whenever he wanted a creative term, a name, he would look it up. And he said, oh, Fen, that's a marshy area. So let's name this place I'm working on in Boston the Fenway. so he was very creative. He understood public relations. You know, look at Central Park. There are gates all around the park. Every one of those gates has a clever name.
Lawrence Hott, his film Frederick Law Olmsted, Designing America, will be broadcast on PBS stations tomorrow night. It'll be at 9 o'clock on Channel 13 here in New York. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.